fully aghast. My mumbled point about loaning War Magi to the commandos went virtually unnoticed, even by Rad. So great was his thoughtfulness at seeing the new form of our foe. But that didn't stop them from discussing the ongoing rape of Gilmora. The newest reports from the region detailed terrible raids on the remaining villages north of the river. Using magic, treachery, and subterfuge, entire hamlets were being swept up by Gervani slavers, herded into pens, chained neck to neck, and eventually marched north, into shadow. There seemed to be little that could be done to combat the raids, save post more vigilant guards, more robust defensive spells, and move people to more secure sites. The lack of manpower to combat the raids was discussed. There were few rangers in the civilized countryside of Gilmora, and though reports of humans resisting behind the lines were frequent, it was difficult to communicate or coordinate with these irregulars. That left much of what we knew about Gilmora dependent upon the observations of the cavalry patrols that swept its periphery. "We need more intelligence on the ground," Salgo said for the third time that afternoon. "I hate sending in the commando units blind like that." "Then let's get some," I finally said, staring at the map. "We can start seeding the area with clandestine refuges and fortifications," I offered. "If the Gavani are going to give us a gift of time this summer, let's use it. If we insert a number of small units into the countryside, reoccupy a few manors and castles, we can coordinate with the resistance, rescue the slaves, and do some forward observation on our foes. But we'll need rangers," I added. "Cannot the Kasari be hired for this? It seems a task ready-made for them." "They are creatures of the wilderlands," Rad dismissed. "Great hunters and trackers in the wilds. But this is Gilmora. Begging your majesty's pardon, but this is a bit of the wilderlands that leaked into Gilmora," I offered. "The Kasari might be a bit out of their element, but I dare say so are we. But they are woodcrafty and cautious, and excellent observers." "Good point," the monarch grudgingly admitted. "I'll send word to their chief, and you will be able to supply War Magi for support?" "Several," I agreed. "They'll need to learn the countryside anyway, if there is a campaign next spring. The levies from Ramir and Wenchar are making their way downriver now," suggested an aide. "They will be ready to quarter for the winter if there is sufficient space."
"Good gods, we will find some," Salgo swore. "I have fields ready for encampments in Barrowbelt, Darkfallen, Gavard, Liston, and other places. I just need the men."
"You do realize that imposing on my great nobles for troops so early in my reign presents difficulties, do you not?" asked Rad, his eyes looking worried.
"And does His Majesty realize that by mobilizing his great nobles' military, he deprives them of the means of rebelling?" reminded Salgo.
Again Rad grunted. He still wasn't happy about the need. It was a short meeting. It wasn't that Rad and Salgo didn't get along, or didn't like each other. The nature of their roles put them in conflict. Rad was a military leader, but he also had a political battle to wage. Salgo had to execute his military duties in spite of politics, and he was loath to take them into account. They both had the best interests of the kingdom at heart. They just didn't agree on what those were. The differences in position and character put them at odds, not their personalities. They both had power, as I did, but they were both beset by the limitations of that power. But I was glad that I did not have to contend with that relationship on a daily basis. I took the opportunity of being in a delightful town like Wilderhall to do some shopping. As many of the craftsmen and artisans who catered to the nobility in Verone had fled to Wilderhall, competition was stiff, and prices were good. I felt compelled to buy a few small presents while I was there, for Alia, little Min, the baby, Dara, Tyndall, Rondell, my nephew, even a present for Sire Kay's new son. Gift-giving is actually a large part of the feudal economy. Whether ostentatious or pragmatic, a lord was expected to be open-handed and generous when it came to his friends, family, vassals, and overlords. Further, there is a decided art to the practice that can gain or lose a man his honorable reputation. I had more money than I knew what to do with, and a long list of people I felt obligated to. Wilderhall provided some unique opportunities for fulfilling that list. Sir Festaren accompanied me, after we were settled down into spacious quarters in the appropriate tower. His unique talent for estimation was canny at ferreting out the best bargains in Wilderhall's luxurious markets. Shoes, tapestries, cloth, and books all went on to my account, after getting Festaren's approval. We must have ordered a wagon's worth of goods when we were done, but a great deal of my list was dealt with. I spent the afternoon inspecting the operation of the mirrored tower of Wilderhall. The king had ordered that an actual turret along the wall between the inner and outer bailey of the castle be given over to the arcane orders, which included the use of a largish hall on the outer side of the wall, proximate to the tower. The actual chamber of the mirror was just a quiet, small room in the upper portion of the tower that held the basin, the enchantment, and a desk for the monitor to write down his messages. Three young magi had been hired by Harterion, on behalf of the order, to vigilantly attend the mirror, take down any messages, and relay any messages given promptly. They were dedicated, I knew. Each was in training and aspired to becoming high magi someday. Getting paid 9 silver pennies for an 8-hour shift of staring into a bowl of water was generous duty. The attendants and the complex were overseen by a middle-aged enchanter, a friend of Harterian's named Dejali, from Wenshar, and he seemed a capable enough man. The name of promoting the arcane orders, I had Harterian cast a special green mage light to hang over the tower like a looking-glass-shaped beacon. It was a bit gaudy for the refined luxury of Wilderhall, but that was the point. The arcane orders were open for business here. The next morning was a market day, and I paid nearly an ounce of silver to have the city urchins spread the news far and wide that any man could pay to have a message sent to the Tower of Castabriel or farther. By the end of the day, Dejali had collected fees from 2 nobles, eager to try out the service. I made a concerted effort to bury myself in my work at Wilderhall, conscious of the fact that the pretty little town and picturesque castle were both the centre of the family's insidious web. Not only was Mother, Queen Grendine, in residence, but her aged executioner and keeper of secrets, Lady Arnett, the mistress of lands and estates, lived here full-time. I did my best to avoid them both. I thought I was pretty safe. Grendine was obsessed with her son's impending wedding, and the decrepit old lady stayed within the crypt-like confines of her office. They had no need to bother me, I reasoned. But when I was taking luncheon, on my 3rd day in the town, stopping at an inn I'd seen and fancied before, I was drawn back within their web. I'd sent Festaren off on a few errands, so was returning from a meeting on foot when I saw the place, the Elusive Heart, and decided to try it, as it seemed favoured by the locals as much as by the lower tier of courtiers and state officials. I ordered a bowl of potatoes and bacon, with a half-loaf of bread and a bottle of wine, taking my meal on the stately second-floor balcony. I had only been there for a few moments when the chair next to me was suddenly occupied by a beautiful young woman. I was instantly on my guard. I was right to be.
"Mother sends her regards, step-brother," she said formally.
That was the family's code for "the Queen sent me." "Brother-in-law," I corrected. I'd created the title after Radine, Grendine's power-mad daughter, tried to have me killed after the Battle of Timberwatch and her assassination of Duke Lenguin. I didn't want to be regarded as a foster son by the bloodthirsty maids of the family. The partial relation of being a brother-in-law was more accurate to my disposition. Magic and politics made poor mates, but if I was to be wedded to the family, it would be on my own terms.
"As you wish," she said,
nodding her pretty head. She was a delicately boned brunette, dressed in finery suited to a courtier, but without any heraldry or insignia upon her gown or jewellery. She could have been a newly-wed noblewoman, a rich man's mistress, or an expensive whore, from the cut of her gown and the way she carried herself. I was certain that she could play any of those roles flawlessly.
"Mother is concerned, brother-in-law,"
she began. "Mother worries a lot," I shrugged. "Thus is Trigg's curse to the well-born woman blessed with a big family."
I said, "Concerned, not worried,"
she countered. "Mother is concerned that her brother-in-law is meddling in family affairs that do not concern him."
"Hmm? Me? What have I done?"
Empowering a disinherited heir, like Mage Lord Draenus, upsets the delicate balance of power, she said, alluding to the son of a count who was diligently working on restoring his patrimony. I rewarded a faithful mage for his service, I pointed out. He has done his time on the front lines, and now he pursues his personal interests. As far as I can tell, he's playing by the rules when it comes to pursuing his legacy.
Rules or no rules, his actions are making waves, warned the pretty girl.
What is particularly concerning to Mother is that she does not yet know the gentleman's disposition toward the family.
In that I can help, I offered. He is not opposed to declaring his loyalties publicly, provided that his claim is backed by those whose loyalty he declares. Indeed, his loyalty could be absolute, if the right incentives were given. But he's not going to declare outright for a faction that is not going to aid his interests. I really had no idea if that was the case. I barely knew the man. But I had an obligation to protect my people's interests, and stick my tongue out at the family.
Mother appreciates your assistance, she said after a moment's thought. That does clarify things. But her concern remains. This matter was not in your purview,
she pointed out. I disagree, I demurred. It is inevitable that these little disagreements arise, in a family as close as this one. I understand that some matters must be negotiated, and that undue interference from outside is not appreciated. But when our interests overlap, I think it would be best to proceed with caution and communication, lest there be misunderstandings.
Which is why we are having this pleasant conversation. But it might be unwise to consider this a negotiation.
Mother is not in the habit of negotiating.
Which is why I had misgivings about marrying into this family, I pointed out. But Mother should look at this as a challenge and an opportunity.
Mother is likewise concerned about the number of high magi suddenly appearing, she countered, her eyes shifting. There seem to be a great many of them.
Our men are very good at harvesting Irionite, I shrugged. Mother was the last person I wanted to know about my new trove of stones. She was the one I was worried about seeing them as a threat to the regime. That's why I had been bestowing them as quietly as possible. I give them only to the worthiest. Considering how many have been granted, the few problems we've been having should demonstrate that.
They do not seem like small problems.
The petty nobility are unhappy with the sudden change in power. The barons, likewise. There is uneasiness among the nobility.
And the peasants are scared shitless of goblins and dragons. Surely a few ambitious mage lords isn't going to offset the benefit we bring to the kingdom. As to those very few problems, they are being attended to.
Too slowly,
she said, shaking her beautiful head.
Mage Lord, we are not trying to cause friction in the family, but you do understand the delicate nature of the regime right now.
We understand the burdens of the task which you have undertaken, but importance of stability in the kingdom should not be underestimated.
We have been very supportive, I would say. Even appreciative. Threats and leverage aren't going to make us more so. We need high magi to fight the war. We need them to support the war effort. As long as Mother is agreeable to that, and allows us to govern our own affairs, we should be able to keep the conflict to a reasonable minimum.
Assistance in the rebellious regions would be more of a token of your loyalty, she said directly.
There aren't any Gavanni in the rebellious regions, I pointed out. That would be operating outside of my purview. Mother has her own magi, I reminded her. If she needs arcane assistance, she has it.
I will relay that to her,
the nameless agent agreed.
Good day, Mage Lord.
M'lady, I nodded, not standing as she departed. Suddenly I wasn't so hungry anymore. It wasn't a direct threat, I reasoned, so I shouldn't do anything hasty. At most it was an attempt to put the order, in its place. I could understand the reluctance to see a bunch of high magi strutting around, toppling their neighbors at a whim. It had happened before in the Magocracy. But I wasn't an archmage. I was the spellmonger. I wasn't playing politics for my idle amusement. I was defending the kingdom that I was partially responsible for creating. It irritated me that Mother could be so bold as to send one of her pretty daughters out to speak with me. Yet I had to admit it was an improvement over those clandestine personal interviews. The scenery, if nothing else, was far better. I got up and decided to take a walk, leaving a few pennies on the table. As I walked, I could not help but feel the eyes of Mother's spies upon me. It didn't bother me, really. I wasn't doing anything suspicious. But it amused me to pause and light my pipe during my walk back to the palace, and cast a sigil in the road that my tail was destined to walk through. Sure enough, a few moments later, the wandering errand boy, who always seemed to be doing something innocuous when I looked back, gave a strangled cry as he stumbled into my gut-hammer sigil. He shat himself on the spot and passed out in a pool of his own waste. I considered recommending he rethink his career in espionage, but I doubt it would have done any good. That sort is addicted to pursuing power through manipulation. Power. Why would anyone want it? My life would be far simpler, I reflected as I crossed the river to the palace, if the goblins had stayed in the mountains and left me to be the spellmonger I was, now only in name. I liked Wilderhall. It's a good city to be in, if you are wealthy, and I spent the rest of the day sightseeing, drinking, and enjoying myself in solitude as I wandered through the city streets. I even found a dice game in a tavern frequented by guardsmen, and did them the courtesy of losing more money than they make in a month while entertaining them with stories from the war. It felt good, somehow, to indulge in the camaraderie of strangers when I had so many problems to contend with. But by the end of the night, I felt much better for the time alone. As I approached the palace, I was favored with a beckoning from a pretty whore who was casually examining the flowers along the wall, while simultaneously displaying her wares in a subtle enough way to be a credit to her craft.
"Lonely, my lord?"
she asked, with just the right amount of receptivity and lust in her voice. She was adorable, maybe 16 or 17, the bloom of youth fresh on her lips and eagerness in her eyes. Perhaps some nobleman's bastard, or a noble woman herself fallen on hard times. She wore her allure like a silky mantle. "Sometimes," I admitted, knowing that wasn't exactly the clear-cut interest she sought. She bit her lip just a little and came closer. Close enough for me to smell her. It was a hot night, and her perfume wafted up over me like a shroud.
"I'm Fari,"
she purred, leaning into my chest and putting her hand behind my neck.
"A big, handsome lord like yourself should not be wandering around in the dark, feeling lonely."
"Sorry, lass," I smiled, enjoying the attention for once. This whore did not know me as the spellmonger, I thought. It was possible that she could be a plant by the family, I supposed, but if she was, I didn't mind making her work at it. "I am wed."
"What Ishi whispers in the darkness need not be spoken of by Trigg's bedside,"
she pointed out. A theological rationalization of infidelity. How novel. "How would I know it would be worth the coin?" I asked, not grabbing her but not pulling her off me either. Her breasts pressed up against my tunic, her hips thrust square with mine. I had no doubt she knew she'd had the desired effect.
"My lord," she said sweetly, "I was tutored at the Crimson Arts by the Joy Sisters of Ishi,"
she bragged. "I have skills beyond what your poor bride can boast. Skills that will call me to mind in your bed for years to come." I considered just that very thing. I dug into my purse, rooting around for a coin, and realized that the guardsmen had taken nearly all of it. But one thick, new ounce of gold remained in my purse, along with a bit of silver. "Fari, have you ever earned an entire ounce of gold for one assignation?" Her eyes bulged.
"No, my lord,"
she whispered. Then she swallowed and paused before looking down.
"What would my lord have me do?"
No doubt all sorts of horrible things ran through her mind, and I admit that part of me considered finding out just how much of her virtue an entire ounce of gold might purchase. But I had a better idea. "Fari, I want you to go into the palace. Yes, the palace. I'll get you in. And I want you to go up to my room. There you will find a young, somewhat handsome knight, with the tiniest bit of a stutter, and all the innocence of a novice hearth sister. Now, I want you, Fari, to go into that room. and I want you to earn this gold. I want you to do your best to give an entire ounce of gold's worth of value to that young man.
Is he poxed?
She asked skeptically. Nope, a couple of blemishes. He's trying to grow a beard.
Is he cruel?
She asked in a whisper. I'm not certain that would have dissuaded her. No, he is the very model of the idealistic country knight.
Then why must you spend so much for a night with him, when much less would suffice?
Because I have power, my dear, I said with a heavy sigh. And power, believe it or not, gets boring as hell if you don't use it for something worthwhile every now and again. Like rewarding a loyal vassal for honourable service, or making the knight of a pretty young whore. If one little ounce of gold can do that, well, as long as I have enough to have a few more drinks at the tavern while you go to work, then I will count myself satisfied, for the moment, with my damned power. Fari looked at me strangely.
My lord, are you all right?
Never better, my sweet, I assured her. I'm just getting old, and I'm finding that's actually not such a bad thing sometimes. Chapter 17 The Wonders of Sevendor. The moment we came out of the transport, I had the sense that we were being watched. I didn't move sharply, not having any context for the feeling, but as Sir Festaren and I came into existence on top of Matten's helm, there were definitely eyes on me, besides those of Lady Fallowen. I turned slowly and looked around the place, but didn't see anyone in the serene little mountaintop garden, until I looked up. There, at various points around the spire's architecture above me, were perched four falcons, the size of horses.
"Oh, dear gods!"
Sir Festaren whispered, his eyes cast overhead. Those...
They had to perch somewhere,
Thalwyn explained quietly. Those are... giant falcons, I finally managed.
Yes, they are,
the Alka Alon woman agreed, as she took a step closer to them.
This is the special project we've been working with Lenodara on.
Growing really big birds.
Transgenic enchantment,
she reminded me.
Shifting one genetic essence between templates is difficult. Merely enlarging the scale of a creature is actually quite a bit easier.
And so you made giant birds? I asked, my mind whirling.
It helps solve several problems,
she said, utterly reasonably, while a raptor the size of a destrier eyed me like a plump mouse from overhead.
We need better surveillance on the ground, and while the smaller birds are useful, with beast magic, the larger the bird, the more ground they can cover. Then there's the matter of defending against dragons. There is little one can do if a dragon hovers overhead and sears the land with flame. These proud fellows are big enough to at least discomfort a dragon. Properly armed and trained, they could provide an effective defense.
Where did you get them? I asked, confounded, while Sir Festaren tried to control his desire to seek a corner.
Why, you sent them to us. From the Wilderlands,
Fallowen said.
When Lenodara told us they had arrived, we were thrilled. We thought you had intended on them being used.
I did, I conceded, but I had more mundane plans in mind.
But why didn't you ask me about this?
I asked. These are magnificent, surely, but Ishi's sweet smile, Fallowen. These are big enough to ride.
That's the intention,
she nodded.
In time we will train them to the saddle, and they will be able to bear a rider. A few years from now,
she said, looking admiringly at the closest female.
But eventually these raptors will see their way into battle.
You did say I could talk to the Alka Alon, Dara reminded me defensively.
You said I could practice magic and read, quietly. But I got bored. Then all these new birds arrived, and the two new hawk masters, and when Lady Varen suggested, well, it seemed like a good idea.
I don't know what to think of this, I said, as the birds' heads darted back and forth. I think it's a good idea, but I would have preferred to be consulted. I guess, I said, as I suddenly put together a number of little things Dara had said over the last few months.
I guess I was, but I just wasn't ready. How many are so transformed?
Only these four, and Frightful,
Thalloan said, enjoying my discomfort a little, I think.
Frightful was returned to normal size, but the enchantment remains on her, latently. Once we get a few pairs of these beasties breeding...
What? You intend on making this permanent?
Only as permanent as the dead god, she declared.
But this gives us some advantages, at least for now.
As I said, the enchantment was relatively simple, and the Council doesn't mind transforming animals as much as sentient beings. Long story. But a few breeding pairs will ensure the line will continue, and there might be other creatures we can employ in a similar manner, she said.
They really haven't been that much trouble, Dara insisted, defiantly, as she peered up at one of her hungry-looking charges.
They stay out of everyone's way until you call them, and they do eat a lot. I had to pay for 4 goats from Jerlaw's hold since we started nesting them here. That is, until we figure out where we can put them permanently, she added a little guiltily.
I envisioned stables the size of palaces, kennels as big as feast halls. 10 men to a horse? Or should they just ride their hounds into battle? What about a savage tabby cat the size of a leviathan? The possibilities beckoned. But so did the headaches, I noted, as I took a last look at the 4 massive falcons. We're going to need a bigger mews, I said simply, and started down the trail to the foot of the hill. I was tired. I wanted to go home, and not as a falcon's lunch. Other than the sudden appearance of large, goat-eating falcons in the skies, things had been quiet in Sevendor in the 3 weeks I'd been away. The crops were growing, the folk were resting and preparing for harvest, and already the booths and tents for the magic fair, almost 2 months away, were being erected on the commons. I spent a full day alone with Alia, making up for lost time. Despite my brushes with infidelity, once I was safely back in her arms, there was no doubt or consideration. I took the healer's words to heart and did the best I could. If Alia detected any reluctance or hesitation on my part, she had the good grace not to call it to my attention. It was a happy reunion. But business had not halted while I'd been absent, merely stockpiled. I had a pile of correspondence to get through. Most had been delivered in the traditional way, by messenger, including a few missives from vassals, or vassals of vassals, invitations to balls and tournaments, and a few personal letters. Of interest was the pile in my workshop labelled Mirror Messages by Dara. There were 3 or 4 of compelling interest, as they pertained to order business, particularly Mage Lord Drainer's successful duel with his younger half-brother, but then there were nearly 2 dozen of more dubious value. Dara? I asked patiently, as she puttered around the workshop while I worked. Why do I have 19 messages from Castabriel declaring that it's noon?
Oh,
she said, struggling to remember. That's because someone thought it would be a good idea to start telling the other mirrors when it was noon in Castabriel to help coordinate the watches. So every day, right at noon, the Castabriel watchman announces that to each mirror in turn. Since every message is to be written down without fail, she reminded me, that means that every tower writes down that it's noon every day. And I end up with a pile of messages telling me that it's noon, I pointed out. Well, I suppose that's helpful. Mostly it's not.
We're still working on the details of the scheme, she supplied smoothly. I'll keep those in a separate pile in the future.
Other matters were less prosaic. Telemann had taken to dictating his general dispatches over the mirror in Barrowbell, closest to the Gilmoran front. His latest was a decided plea for more assistance in preparing the Gilmoran lands for battle. In particular, he was requesting more High Magi to probe and investigate the contested halls of Gilmora. I contacted him mind to mind to see just how serious he was. Turns out, he was very serious. I've got plenty of High Magi who can keep castles from crumbling, he told me when I got a hold of him. I've got War Magi who can lead a charge or run a siege. But I don't have anyone who can be sneaky enough to keep from getting killed long enough to tell us about what's really going on in Gilmora.
I've spoken to Rad about scouts, I told him helpfully.
I suggested he hire the Kasari.
That's a good plan, if he can get them to come, he admitted, but we need people with a background in magic.
I thought for a moment, what if I offered you one of my apprentices?
Which one?
Which one do you want?
The mission will require some strength, some stealth, and a lot of nerve. I want to start infiltrating behind their lines with small groups, no more than 20, 30 men at a time. We're afraid that more than that might attract attention, but once we get them inserted into Gilmora, they can tell us what the Gavani are really up to. They've been very secretive about what has been coming down the road in the last few weeks. I wondered how much of that was due to my efforts. While Azar's raid on Ghislaine Manor had been exploratory, there was no denying that we'd gotten away with some damning evidence. I told Telemann about the raid and the rescue, and my encounter with the Night Sail. He had read a dispatch from Azar about it, but appreciated the first-hand account. When he heard about the great goblin corpse we'd captured, he understood at once what it foretold. Height, strength, endurance, horses, they'll be almost a match for us. You're right. That may have accelerated their timetable, if you tipped their hand.
Azar tipped it. I merely came along as an observer.
You're full of shit. Azar's dispatch said differently. Min, what are we going to do? If we have to face 500,000 of these great goblins coming down the road, the good news is that we'll see them coming. They can't prepare a force of any size without us having weeks of notice. We've already got troops headed for Gilmora. We've got more war magi in the field than we ever could have hoped for. Alka Alon assistance, and I still have a few tricks in reserve, I bluffed. If the Gavani haven't started a muster to invade by now, they won't do so before autumn. That would put their force on the road during the worst of the rainy season.
Do you think that will matter? He reminded me. With magic, they can keep that road clear.
We have to stop thinking in human terms of warfare with them. The Gavani don't carry huge wagon trains full of supplies and artillery. It wouldn't take much to get them down the road.
We're vigilant, I repeated, but your point is well taken. And we can't hold that road, nor even guard it sufficiently against an advance. But perhaps if we fortify the choke points, particularly the bridges.
The Gavani aren't fond of water, he agreed. If a column did stick to the road, those bridges would be vital, and there are only a few of them. The river lords of Gilmora were jealous of their feudal privileges, and a juicy toll over a stout bridge, and the opportunity to feed and supply travellers, was a lucrative one. That kept the right to build and maintain bridges in a region a carefully guarded prerogative. We could fortify those regions, at least, slow them down until our defences were in place.
You're an optimist, he accused, but that's better than standing by the road and watching them march by.
That's one reason why I wanted to borrow one of your apprentices. Rondal, I think. I received outstanding reports from War College, both in the mysteries and in war magic. He has a lot of leadership potential.
What did you have in mind?
As I said, I need to establish a greater presence in the occupied territories, if not large enough a force to dispute their rule, at least enough to contest it, and gather intelligence. Count Salgo wants to seed the area with royal commandos and small, fast mobile units. He also wants clandestine installations, stations and bases from which a real insurgency could be launched, when they arrive in force.
I know. I suggested it to him.
The idea has merit. You want Rondal to be part of this?
The boy was ready, I figured.
I want him to command the pilot squad and prepare the first station, Telemann supplied. He's got the thaumaturgic and practical knowledge to interpret good field observations.
Rondal? In command?
I've been assured he can handle the mission.
If he's got sufficient motivation, I agreed.
How about you take both of them?
Both?
Tyndall too?
Yes.
He's not as scattered as he lets on, and to be honest, they keep each other out of trouble. Besides, it will be good for him to be Rondal's second in command for a change.
I suppose it wouldn't hurt to have a spare apprentice around, and it would just be for a few weeks, until we can get the Royal Commando units established.
But I want Magi eyes on the place in detail before those brutes go smashing everything in sight.
So noted. I'll inform them.
It will be a rude trial after the cushy errantry they've been on, but it's time they got back to the war.
I'll inform them at once. Besides, I noted, summer is almost over anyway.
The Alka Alon were less impressed by the strange new goblin corpse I'd brought along. I had it taken to my workshop by a squad of Tal from Hollyborough, well wrapped against discovery, and a few days after I arrived, I had the three emissaries examine it in detail. The results were depressing.
"This is not good at all, Mage Lord,"
Lady Varen said, as she straightened from her examination.
"I have never seen one of these myself, but..."
"Wait. You've heard of these before?" I asked. "I thought this was something new."
"No, sadly enough.
Once during the Alka Alon's wars, there were those who took our servants and made them into soldiers through enchantment. Their inner nature is largely unchanged, but how it is expressed is far more vicious."
"But why?"
"When certain unpopular factions could not recruit sufficient soldiery among the Alka Alon, they turned to other means. Gavanni proved highly effective in these forms. Some among the Dradrien and the Karshak Alon were subjected to such violent forms. At the conclusion of the wars, such enchantments were proscribed."
"But clearly the knowledge has not been lost,"
Lady Fallowen observed.
"Those were dark days. To think that the abomination would raise such deviations from the past is unthinkable. This, Mage Lord, more than any other clue, points to the abomination receiving Alka Alon assistance. Only the Alka Alon, and certain lines and families, could possibly have knowledge of such enchantments."
"Such a thing would require much power," Lady Ithalia agreed. "Nor would it be a simple task. But once done, the enchanted Gavanni would breed true. All of the warrior forms of the Alon were more aggressive," she added. "Just as these human forms gave us the perspective of your race, so did these dark forms infect the minds of their victims. You can see why transgenic enchantment was such a controversial subject," Lady Varen continued. "A simple transformation, changing an Alkan to a human analogue, or changing the scale of a falcon, these are simple enough things. But when the spellsinger begins shaping the subtleties of the life force to their whim, perversions abound. This savage species, once stormed citadels, millennia old," Fallowen said distastefully, "under the direction of fanatics, too extreme to attract a following of their own, deadly, loyal, and disposable.
Could this development, then, convince your council to intervene more forcefully in this affair?" I asked, pointedly.
"Mage Lord, if the abomination is raising dragons and enchanting Gavanni in this way, it may prove beyond the council's ability to contend with. These are relics of dark ages past," Fallowen said with a shiver. "We thought the power to create them was long past. So might be the power to defeat them."
I was musing on the possibility of secret weapons in my workshop a few days later, when I received a visit from my two non-human magical specialists, Stonesinger Ashkuri and Master Onranyan, an adept in Alkan songspells. Master Ashkuri was ancient, born during the last days of the Majocracy, from what his grandson, Master Guri, had told me. He was kind of the patriarch over the Karshak Lodge, and was solemnly accounted one of the best stone singers of the age. He had certainly impressed me when he first sang the mountain. It had been he who had discovered the deposits of crystals and other minerals that had been affected by the snow that never melted. The waystones had been the easiest to identify, and the most immediately useful, but he had been studying the rest of my exotic rock collection for months now. Onranyan, for his part, had taken a passionate interest in the unique minerals. He had brought over 1,000 years of specialized understanding through the vehicle of Alka Alon magic practiced as a high art. Onranyan was adept at the intricacies of the thaumaturgically exotic. I figured that their overlapping and complementary disciplines would prove helpful, and I wasn't wrong. They looked positively triumphant. After reviewing Dara's unexpected avian experiment, I was a little leery of experimental thaumaturgy. But I had an expert in the field in Master Onranyan. He and old Ashkuri
had been consulting with each other about the various stones in my vault, and they had something to show me. They also looked half-drunk. Onranian was developing a fine appreciation for wine. They were excited about something having to do with the stones.
"This,"
Ashguri said in his gravelly voice, as he set the first of the small crystals in front of me in my workshop,
"is an amazing find."
With a twinkle in his eye, he chanted a chorus of something in his own language, and the hammer on the table disappeared. He held out his hand and said another word, and it reappeared.
"I think it establishes a smaller, separate dimension," Onranian theorized. "When I examined it in the Ranara scale, I noticed that when empowered it had the capacity for inflating Saras between the Felsari."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," I said honestly.
"Think of reality as resting on a framework," he said after a moment's pause, "like the framework of a house. This stone allows one who knows its operation to inflate the framework, insert a little extra room between the beams, so to speak. It's more like establishing a new dig in a mine,"
countered Ashguri.
"You're just hollowing out a little extra space."
"How much extra space?"
"How much do you need?" asked Ashguri. "Theoretically, it would only depend upon the amount of power you provided during the inception of the space."
"A cubic foot? A mile?"
"How much power do you want to spend?"
smirked Onranian.
"That's the only limitation. It could be large enough to house a city, theoretically. There are many variables that must be established upon inception, but once that is done, the effect seems to be permanent. Access is the tricky part, although Master Ashguri has formulated equations that would make such things possible."
"What sort of things?"
"Practical uses, gentlemen," I encouraged. This was fascinating. "Oh, need a place to stash your tools? You got your own tool bag here. Want to take all your crops to market in your pocket? You can do it without a wean. Want to collect seashells? Put them in your magical pocket until it can't hold any more."
"So how do you get them in and out?"
"Simple runic key," shrugged the Karshak. "Mnemonic device. Key the artifact. Open it by just about anything. Song, word, sound, sneeze, interpretive dance. Just about anything. But just be careful about how you build it," he cautioned. "There's no telling exactly how the thing works."
"But it works." The hammer in his hand disappeared, and then appeared in his other hand.
"Oh, aye,"
he assured me, a twinkle in his eye.
"It works."
"And how many of these stones do we have?"
"Just the three,"
Ashguri said with a nod.
"Some lesser ones might do it if you played with them, but these three are the special ones. I call them pocket stones, although that insufferable Alcan is trying to come up with something grander." "That's nothing compared to what this beauty does," Onranian said, digging out another one from the box he'd brought. "This is the truly unique one. Only one like it in the entire collection."
"So what does it do?"
"From what I can tell, it allows temporary thaumaturgic enneagrams to become permanent,"
Onranian said, authoritatively. I almost understood that part.
"You should. It's simple. When you establish a rudimentary symbolic enneagrammatic array, like you do to conjure a simple water elemental, the effect degrades after a while, correct?"
"Yes. Depending on just how complex it is and how much energy you put into the system."
"Just so. Eventually the template used to model the system, yours, degrades as attention and intent fails. Once it can no longer sustain thaumaturgic cohesion, it fades back into the chaos of its creation. This little gem allows you to establish that pattern permanently."
"You mean, create a permanent water elemental?"
"Oh, my dear boy, elementals are just the beginning. There are all manner of such enneagrammatic patterns that fail due to static forces. This would allow them to become self-sustaining, or at least maintain their coherency long enough to find a means of sustenance. Theoretically, of course. We'll have to do some experiments, naturally."
"Well, naturally, I want you to keep them quiet. Could this be used as a weapon?"
All may. Yes,
the old Alcan said, scratching his chin. You could cause all sorts of mischief with this.
Unseen assassins, unkillable golems, you could even sustain a living enneagram after death.
I could make undead with this.
Anyone can do it temporarily, he mused, once you understand the basic necromantic principles, but only at a basic level. This could be used to affix a being's core enneagram, maintain its existence intact after biology has failed. It would require power, a lot of power, but that is essentially what the abomination is. Only this stone, theoretically, can do the same thing without a block of virionate.
That sounds a little horrific, I said, swallowing involuntarily.
Oh, it would be frightful, he agreed cheerfully. Locked inside a body that no longer truly functioned? A living death of endless torment. But from a more practical standpoint, this stone allows such enchantments to be made permanent.
That opened up all sorts of possibilities, and we spent the rest of the afternoon and three more bottles of wine exploring them in my workshop. Hangovers, I hear, are very inspirational. We spent hours experimenting after that. For 2 days, I ignored almost everything but those two stones, until I thought I had the beginnings of understanding them. Ashguri was particularly helpful in mastering the intricacies of the Magrathiite, as he called the three pocket stones. Under his guidance, we established a protocol for creating openings and attaching them to physical objects as activation mnemonics. I was able to create a space that could call my mage blade, Twilight, into and out of existence, for example, which I found handy. I tied it to a thick gold seal ring I'd had made in preparation for my investiture celebration, bearing the arms of Sevendor. Now, when I wore the ring and activated the command, the sword would appear in my palm, and then disappear at another command, just a short dimension away.
That, I said, after the fifth or sixth time doing it, is some classy magic. That's something few Alcan spellsingers have mastered, agreed Onranyan.
I just like not having to lug a mage blade around everywhere, I agreed. Let's see what else we can do. The other stone, the enneagrammatic affixer, or whatever the technical term was the more difficult to master. Onranyan called the thing the Alaran stone, the Alka-Alon word for sustaining. Creating a permanent magical fountain in the mill pond made pulling swords out of the air seem like a cheap trick. It took a day's worth of fiddling with it, but eventually the water elemental we conjured spouted a spray of water over half of the bathing area every 15 minutes. Forever. The pattern of symbolic commands and logical structures that provided its simple enneagrammatic template did not degrade after a few hours, like normal. It was still as strong and vibrant 3 days later. Both types of stone were dangerous to tinker with. We still did not know much about the extra-dimensional spaces we were creating, nor about the mechanism of transport. But we established how to use some of the stone's rare properties, and it gave us plenty of ideas for further research. It had been fun, I reflected, as I watched the distant sparkle of the magical fountain in the twilight from the summit of my tower. It had been an exercise in pure research, with the ostensible utility of assisting the war effort. But it had also been utterly unassociated with my duties as mage lord, baron, or head of the arcane orders, ambassador to the Alka-Alon, or even husband to my wife, or father to my son. A pure intellectual exercise with a demonstrable conclusion. It was quite satisfactory. As distractions go, it wasn't bad. But I had work to get back to, and had to let Ashguri and Onranyan continue the experiments without me. We would follow up later. I wanted Taran and other thaumaturges and enchanters involved eventually. But for now, I had to put my funny hats back on and be important. Of looming importance was the approach of the Magic Fair, which would also celebrate my investiture, and establish the new Barony of Sevendor in the Bontal Riverlands. All my vassals and most of my neighbours would be there, as would most of the Magi who could find their way to my little land. The vassals would require special attention, I knew. There was near revolt in Northwood Domain, thanks to some agitation and 2 generations of managerial neglect. That would have to be dealt with.
But before that, I was scheduled to meet with the Sevendor Town Council to discuss the proposed new charter. Once I had become a baron, empowered to grant an even wider range of privileges, Bannermore had rushed back to the council and redrafted the document. Now he was ready to present it. That put me in a delicate position. I wanted to give him the freedom to develop the town, but I didn't want to give up my authority, nor did I want to cut myself out of some lucrative trade. Being filthy rich, all of a sudden, didn't mean I didn't want my due. Sayake was due back from his summer tour of his estate any day, and when he arrived, we, and a studious law brother I had retained, Brother Chervis, would go over each and every clause, until the nascent burgher was squirming. Matters were even trickier because he was also a vassal, my spell warden, and my business partner. He also ran the magic fair, which kept growing year after year. This was the third year, and it promised to be the biggest attended yet. With my investiture celebration and other festivities, it would be a busy time. Until then, I stole quiet moments like that, watching the sun set over the ridge while the four majestic giant falcons wheeled around Matten's helm and the enchanted spire at its peak. One of the larger ones made a triumphant dive, falling in the air like a stone, only to break out her wings at the last second before she struck. It was truly beautiful, watching the magnificent bird, until I realized I owed someone for a goat. Chapter 18. The Chartered Town of Sevendor. Sevendor was a far cry from the tiny hamlet we'd found when we'd arrived. Now it was a town of nearly 3,000 souls within its loosely defined bounds. There were entire neighborhoods that had sprung up in the last few years, and there was not a single peasant's hut left in the place. Most of the homes were two-story exposed beam and wattle and daub, with some being made of brick. Bannermore's mansion was one of these. The two-story warehouse and shop complex was one of the more imposing buildings in the town, and the steady stream of peddlers and pack traders, wagons and convoys from distant parts arriving at all hours attested to its importance. Bannermore had a staff of six now, not including his deputy spell warden, Gareth. The young man may have been a lousy war mage, but he understood organization. He kept Bannermore's many enterprises running in the man's absence. Along with his own rise, Bannermore had made sure that the town, as a civic entity, had enjoyed a rise as well. Under his leadership, a far grander meeting hall was built, albeit smaller than Bannermore's manse. It had an armory with the militia's arms at one end, and storage for communal items at the other. Most importantly, it had a large meeting hall, capable of holding 100 people downstairs, and three small offices that ran the affairs of the nascent town upstairs. Also upstairs was the town council chamber, a simply appointed room with table and chairs. It was here that the now 9-man council had been meeting almost daily for weeks. Their hired scribe, a near-sighted monk with a permanent frown, had carefully drafted the document they presented me with such ceremony when I arrived for the occasion. I made introductions and Bannermore began to read the contract aloud, page by page. I refused to stand for much ceremony and asked them to sit down around the table without formality. This was a negotiation, after all. They could get to the ass-kissing later. Bannermore frowned when Brother Chervis came in. A cherubic man with an infectious grin, the monk had negotiated several charters before, on behalf of both townsmen and lord. Mage Lord Furrendahl of Robin Wing had recommended him, and I had secured his services at some expense. Sire Kay was also with me, as my witness and bannerman. I'd have Alia read it over too, once we were done, to see if she could spot any unanticipated issues. After the flowery preamble, most of the basics were easy enough to understand. In return for an annual fee of 20 ounces of silver per 100 citizens, the townsfolk were exempt from communal duties to the castle, though individual contracts of servitude would still be honored. The town would give up all right to farm the fields it traditionally did, northwest of town. That area was once again now mine to control, and since much of the fields had been affected by the snowfall spell, it was insanely valuable. In return, the town would now have the freedom to order its own affairs as to organization and administration, formulate and enforce its own internal regulations, and regulate commerce in the markets. Seven Door Town would have its own jurisdiction, the rights of sake and soak for its fee, as well as exemption from tolls throughout the barony. In terms of defense, the town owed one lance, or five archers, for every 100 citizens, or a scutage fee of 20 ounces of silver every year. The town was responsible for maintenance of the streets and roads, including the two bridges. The mill remained under my direct control, as would the bakery I planned to build. I would continue to maintain the dam. Included in the townlands was a new parcel on the other side of the Ketter, which would become the new Commons and Listfield. That was a generous gift, but one outside of the Snowstone Circle. Also included was a stretch behind the spires, north of town. That was Gerlaw's property, and he retained title, but its inclusion made it much more valuable now. It also gave Gerlaw more of a say in Seven Door Town's affairs, and as my yeoman, he would help represent my interests. I reserved some of the land in the neighbourhood of the Listfield for baronial use. If I had to be responsible for housing ducal tax collectors and liquor inspectors, they could live out there. Having a few parcels of my own within town also suited me. The town would run its affairs on the collection of two major assessments, a land gabel on all properties of a silver penny per lot, and a head tax to be collected at Yule and Midsummer. It was effectively a membership due in the town, allowing a man to be considered a burgess of Seven Door. The assessments were not steep. I had heard the land gabel in Sendaria Port was 3 pennies, and the head tax significant. But the benefits of membership were usually far in excess to the cost. Town courts tended to be more lenient than manorial courts, and burgesses were usually exempt from tolls within the domain. The town would be organized by quarter, with 6 wards designated. Each would be organized into 100-person, or 20 families, or hearths, districts, for assessment and organization. A man would be legally responsible to his district, and each district would designate a representative to the town's reeves. Specifically forbidden in the town's charter was permission to encircle it with a wall, though a hedge was permitted. A wall would have helped defend the place in case of an attack, but it would also eat up valuable real estate and cost like the dickens to maintain. Seven Door Vale was as secure as the townsfolk could ask. Besides, towns with walls had a disturbing habit of acting independently. Included in the charter was the right to hold the gates, that is, to establish a watch on the entrances to the town to monitor and collect fees from travellers and tradesmen wishing to do business in town. I scribbled a note to the law brother to have them propose a schedule of reasonable fees for my approval, even though I wasn't asking for a cut. That would be valuable revenue for the town, and while I could get greedy about it, letting Bannermore and his people have that revenue in its entirety made good business sense. I just wanted to keep them from getting greedy about it by keeping entrance fees artificially high. The 4 gate wardens would collect an annual salary of 10 ounces of silver, plus 1% of their monthly take. The constitution of the proposed city watch was included. It accounted for a captain of the watch, paid 20 ounces of silver per year, and 6 watchmen, who would pocket 12 ounces every year. It also accounted for the hiring of up to 12 temporary deputies during the magic fair and other celebrations, at 2 silvers per use. That was reasonable, but I penned a note to increase the number to 16 if needed. The matter of jurisdiction was important. The town wanted the right to appoint a magistrate over civil matters, including trade regulations. While I had no problem with that, I disliked hearing such cases myself, I wasn't happy with Bannermore having the right to pick his own judge. I whispered to Brother Chervis, and we made a counter-proposal. An independent law brother would be hired to run the court for a 3-year contract, non-renewable. Bannermore or any of the council could propose a candidate, but they had to meet with my approval. Mandated in the 4th page of the document was a section regulating the building of any future temples and shrines, hastily appended to the rest of the document. As a baron, I had the power to authorize such institutions, and it was widely anticipated that I would be doing so. Bannermore had designated a strip of land outside of the old commons, soon to be Sevendore Square, as Temple Street, to that end.